Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, October 20th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here's our first story. Justice Department to file law, landmark law antitrust case against Google. The Justice Department is expected to file a lawsuit Tuesday alleging that Google has been abusing its dominance in online search to stifle competition and harm customers, a person familiar with the matter told the Associated Press. The litigation marks the government's most significant act to protect competition since its groundbreaking case against Microsoft more than 20 years ago. The suit could be an opening salvo ahead of other major government antitrust actions, given ongoing investigations of major tech companies, including Apple, Amazon, and Facebook, at both the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. Lawmakers and consumer advocates have long accused Google, whose corporate parent, Alphabet Inc., has a market value of just over $1 trillion, of abusing its dominance in online search and advertising to stifle competition and boost its profits. Critics contend that multi-billion dollar fines and mandatory changes in Google's practices imposed by European regulators in recent years weren't severe enough, and that structural changes are needed for Google to change its conduct. The case is expected to be filed in federal court in Washington, D.C., and will allege Google has been abusing its dominance in online search to stifle competition and harm customers, the person familiar with the matter told the AP. It will also allege that Google uses billions of dollars collected from advertisers to pay phone manufacturers to ensure Google is the default search engine on browsers, the person said. The person could not discuss the matter publicly before a formal announcement expected later Tuesday morning and spoke to the AP on the condition of anonymity. The Trump administration has long had Google in its sights. A top economic advisor to President Donald Trump said 2 years ago that the White House was considering whether Google searches should be subject to government regulation. Trump has often criticized Google, recycling unfounded claims by conservatives that the search giant is biased against conservatives and suppresses their viewpoints, interferes with U.S. election, and prefers working with the Chinese military over the Pentagon. Google controls about 90% of global web searches. The company has been bracing for the government's action and is expected to fiercely oppose any attempt to force it to spin off its services into separate businesses. The company, based in Mountain View, California, has long denied the claims of unfair competition. Google argues that although its businesses are large, they are useful and beneficial to consumers. It maintains that its services face ample competition and have unleashed innovations that help people manage their lives. Most of Google's services are offered for free in exchange for personal information that helps it sell its ads. Google insists that it holds no special power, forcing people to use its free services or preventing them from going elsewhere. A recent report from a House Judiciary Subcommittee following a year-long investigation into big tech's market dominance concluded that Google has monopoly power in the market for search. It said the company established its position in several markets through acquisition, snapping up successful technologies that other businesses had developed, buying an estimated 260 companies in 20 years. The argument for reigning in Google has gathered force as the company stretched far beyond its 1998 roots as a search engine governed by the motto, "Don't be evil." It's since grown into a diverse Goliath with online tentacles that scoop up personal data from billions of people via services ranging from search, video, and maps to smartphone software. That data helps feed the advertising machine that has turned Google into a behemoth. The company owns the leading web browser in Chrome, the world's largest smartphone operating system in Android, and the top video site in YouTube, and the most popular digital mapping system. Some critics have singled out YouTube and Android as among Google businesses that should be considered for diversity. With only 2 weeks to Election Day, the Trump Justice Department is taking bold legal action against Google on an issue of rare bipartisan agreement. Republicans and Democrats have accelerated their criticism of big tech in recent months, although sometimes for different reasons. It's unclear what the status of the government suit against Google would be if Joe Biden's administration were to take over next year. The Justice Department sought support for its suit from states across the country that share concerns about Google's conduct. A bipartisan coalition of 50 U.S. states and territories, led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, announced a year ago they were investigating Google's business practices, citing potential monopolistic behavior. Why are there rising COVID cases in Iowa, but fewer deaths? By Amy Rivers. The chain of events seems forebodingly familiar, recalling the early worst days of the coronavirus pandemic. Cases are rising faster than ever. Iowa reported nearly 3,000 new confirmed coronavirus cases in the last 3 days as of Monday. An average of 1,000 Iowans are being diagnosed daily, well over the state's first peak in mid-May. There were more than 60 outbreaks at long-term care facilities, another record. In recent days, patients entered Iowa hospitals at record numbers. Hospitalizations are rising, as are stays in the intensive care unit. Yet, one variable isn't rising: deaths. By population, Iowa's COVID-19 caseload is 7th in the U.S., but 24th in deaths per capita as of Monday, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Despite deaths being a lagging indicator, those rankings haven't meaningfully changed for months. So why are cases rise, are death not following? We're not seeing patients as sick as they were in April, said Dr. Pradeep Ramesh, medical director of hospitalists at Unity Point Allen Hospital, Waterloo. There are several reasons, according to officials at local hospitals, but one reason looms large. Healthcare professionals have learned a lot about the virus in the last 7 months, Ramesh said. We have become accustomed to caring for people with patients with COVID-19, said Dr. Matthew Sochka, Chief Medical Officer at Mercy One Waterloo. Treatments such as remdesivir and convalescent plasma, as well as steroids like dextromethorphan, are now in ample supply, something that wasn't true months ago. Questions still remain on how effective each treatment is, Ramesh noted, but doctors are seeing better results. Other treatment strategies have changed, particularly the use of ventilators. Initially, data coming from the New York showed that we should have these patients on a ventilator as soon as possible and give the lungs some rest, Ramesh said. Since then, we've learned that people who go on the ventilators have a high mortality rate. Now, both Ramesh and Sojka think the best practice is to delay ventilator use for as long as possible, instead using high-flow oxygen. Sojka said increased ambulation, walking around, as well as proning the patient are new techniques. Proning means having patients lie on their bellies rather than on their backs. It actually really helps patients, Ramesh said. We find that when we flip them over, their oxygenation actually improves a lot. While fewer people are dying, having COVID-19 is no walk in the park. We have seen patients go through a lot. They're in the hospital for a long time. They're in the ICU for a long time, Ramesh said. They get extremely weak. There are a lot of after effects, but ultimately it's marked in the box that says they did not die. That's why I don't want people to underestimate COVID, Ramesh continued. Just because someone doesn't die doesn't mean that they don't go through a lot. Both doctors make it clear social distancing and wearing masks when you can't is critical, as most activists move indoors as temperatures, most activities move indoors as temperatures drop. We are already seeing an uptick in hospitalizations, Ramesh said. That is the fear, that we will see more. Next article. Man arrested for threatening ex with gun, by Jeff Reinitz. Dunkerton. A Charles City man has been arrested for allegedly threatening his ex-girlfriend and holding her against her will in rural Dunkerton in July. Blackhawk County Sheriff's deputies arrested John Omri Bliss, 39, on Sunday for felon in possession of a firearm, aggravated domestic assault, false imprisonment, and obstruction of emergency communications. According to court records, Bliss and the woman were at a friend's home in the 5300 block of East Cedar Wapsie Road on July 7th when an argument broke out. The woman attempted to leave, but Bliss allegedly dragged her out of her vehicle by her hair, put her in another vehicle, and took her keys and cell phone. Over several hours, he beat her, held a knife to her neck, put a gun in her mouth, and threatened to kill her, according to court records. He also fired shots in the air. Bliss is prohibited from handling firearms because a 2011 burglary conviction in Bremer County, according to court records. Campaign Almanac. Complaints climb in U.S. Senate race. The campaigns for Iowa's U.S. Senate candidates, Republican incumbent Joni Ernst and Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield, are facing complaints regarding potential violations of campaign laws. A federal judge has instructed the Federal Elections Commission, which oversees campaign laws, to take action regarding a dark money group, an advocacy organization that is not required to disclose its donors, that allegedly worked illegally to support Ernst's campaign. Over the weekend, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a statement of interest in the case, arguing the judge's instructions should be thrown out. The Iowa Democratic Party and Greenfield's campaign have cried foul that the Federal Justice Department is taking action to support Ernst's campaign. It's the worst kind of Washington corruption for Senator Ernst's allies to help her cover up the dark money scandal she's never answered for after a federal judge ruled the FEC must take action, Greenfield Campaign Communications Director Sam Newton said in a statement. Meantime, the FEC has issued an acknowledgement of a complaint filed by an Iowa Republican against Greenfield's campaign. The campaign, filed by Wesley Enos, a former chairman of the Polk County Republican Party, alleges that Greenfield's campaign illegally accepted an in-kind donation of $900,000 from the Senate Majority PAC when the Iowa Democratic Party, the complaint alleges, illegally provided information to the PAC to use in a campaign ad. Henson, volunteering at Derecho Aid Center is who I am, by James Lynch. State Representative Ashley Henson's campaign for a seat in the U.S. House amounted to a pallet of beans Monday, green beans. Henson, a Republican seeking the congressional seat held by Democratic Representative Abby Finkenauer, and campaign staff members were breaking down a pallet of canned beans and sorting other donations at the Iowa Derecho Storm Resource Center, where she volunteers on a regular basis. The center, started by Raymond Seidel of CenterPoint and Friends, accepts donations of food, clothing, diapers, and other supplies needed by people harmed by the August 10th Hurricane Force derecho. The pandemic and the derecho have been a 1-2 punch hitting families really hard, Henson said, at the center housed in the former service bay of the McGrath Ford dealership in Cedar Rapids. A lot of people who were food secure before the derecho aren't anymore. Children can't focus on learning if you go to school hungry, and parents can't focus on their job if they're worried about feeding their families, Henson said. Seidel didn't expect the need to extend more than 2 months, but plans to continue to collect donations and distribute them to people with needs. He's in the process of organizing his efforts as a nonprofit under the name Together We Achieve. Noting the newly fallen snow, Henson said the center will fill a need for people who may have to choose between heating and eating. She encouraged people to continue to make donations either at the center or online at iowastormhelp.com. About a quarter of Iowa voters already have cast their votes, according to Iowa's Secretary of State, and Election Day is 16 days away. Henson said she was spending time at the Derecho Recovery Center to lead by example. I want to show voters what kind of person I am, she said. I want to show people what kind of a community-minded person I am. In the context of the campaign, Henson said, her volunteering, that she's willing to meet voters, to hear their concerns, and answer their questions. This is an important time for our country to move forward with rebuilding our economy, restoring our way of life, and restoring the American dream, Henson said. I think I'm the candidate here in the 1st District to do that. I'm out listening to people. I'm not hiding. She criticized Finkenauer for not agreeing to more than one debate. However, Finkenauer's spokesman said the Congresswoman has kept a busy schedule of teleton town halls, forums with community groups, and meeting with newspaper editorial boards, which Henson declined to do. Finkenauer is on a 20-day tour of the 20 county district. She spent Monday at a Benton County farm observing extensive derecho damage to farm buildings and crops, as well as the second story of the family's home. The storm took a lot the day that it ripped through, and I'll continue fighting to get at Iowa families' help. The road is long, but Iowans give me hope, Finkenauer posted on Twitter. Most Cedar Falls utility rates set to go up in 2021. Board open to changes before public meeting. Customers using gas, water, and television from Cedar Falls utilities are set to see base rates increases next year. The municipal utility in Cedar Falls released proposed rate changes to its Board of Trustees at a special meeting Friday afternoon, noting the ways the pandemic has affected business in 2020. It seems like everything that could happen in one budget year is happening in this budget year, said Wynette Froner, Director of Finance and Organizational Services for CFU. Under the proposed budget, governmental entities could see an electric base rate increase of 5.9%, while the University of Northern Iowa would see a 2.2% increase, and commercial customers would see a 0.4% increase. Residential customers would not see an increase on their electric bills. But residents would see their base rate increase 5.6% on gas bills. Commercial customers would see a 3.7% increase on gas, while industrial customers would see a 3.6% jump. Governmental entities would have a 2.5% increase, and you and I would see a 3.5% increase. All water customers would face at least a 4% increase. You and I would see a 4.3% increase on water bills, with commercial customers seeing a 4.5% increase, industrial customers a 4.8% increase, a 6.2% increase for residential customers, and a 7.4% increase for governmental customers. For television customers, the basic package would rise $5 in 2021, while basic plus customers would see a bump of an additional $3 for a total of $8. Froner said there were no planned rate increases in internet or phone services for the next 5 years. The utility spent less on capital projects this year, Froner said, but also received much lower than expected revenue from the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO, which CFU joined in 2009. She noted the utility had a net operating income in 2020 of $3,646,052, the majority from the communications side, internet, phone, and television. CFU's biggest expenses were on commodities, 22% for gas purchases, 12% for coal, 28% for purchased power, and 17% for cable programming. Those expenses, General Manager Steve Bernard told the board, were down dramatically over 2019. The market price for commodities has been really, really low this year. That's a good thing for all of us and for our consumers, he said. CFU's energy incentives budget for things like energy inspection and audits of homes and businesses also had to be lowered for the year, down to $868,699 from $1.3 million. One of the things that happened during COVID is commercial and industrial customers put a stop to that, said Mike Litterer, Director of Customer Services and Business Development. The utility's labor cost is expected to climb in 2021 to $1.3 million, budgeting in full staffing of 206 positions, retirement overlap, and estimated raises of 3% and 3.5% for union and non-union staff, Froner said. Board member Dick McAllister noted he had some concerns with the rate increases as well as staffing. It would be nice if we took the time and the courtesy to speak to the schools and the cities about that increasing rate. I believe that with COVID, they're probably going to struggle, McAllister said. McAllister also asked if it was possible to lower the proposed rate changes prior to the public hearing at 2 p.m. November 11th. CFU staff will look into it. I just wonder if we shouldn't be sharpening our pencil a little bit more and be a little more creative as to how we mitigate those to some degree, he said. Editorial, Easing into the Chilly Months. This originally appeared in the October 17th Kearney, Nebraska Hub. It takes October 9 months to get here, but there are reasons we love it so much. It brings an end to yard work, and there's a bit of rest before the blizzards blow in, and it's time to break out the snow shovels. It's a restful month. It's a bit sad because gardens freeze. There are no more fresh tomatoes off the vine, and gone are the bright and delicate flowers that decorate the warm summer months. But just as she erases the lively colors of summer, Mother Nature draws out her magical paintbrush and splashes her canvas with blazing golds, oranges, and reds. October is as fair as it can be. It takes away summer, but it gives us autumn. Weary from the heat of June, July, August, and September, we pause in October to relish the coolness and colors and prepare physically and spiritually for the long trudge through winter. In October, the days are clear, bright, and quiet, except in the fields, where farmers are gathering the fruits of their labors. Each year at this time, the tall corn stalks disappear from the fields, and then golden pyramids of corn appear in rural towns that proudly tie their fortune to agriculture. On the old Roman calendar, October was the eighth month. That's how it got its name, from the Latin word octo, meaning eight. January and February were added with the introduction of the Gregorian calendar in 1582, pushing October to number 10. The change improved the calendar's accuracy, but improvements were not really needed for October, which remains one of our favorites. Ducks, geese, and sandhill cranes must love October too. As the birds arrive here each fall, they're honking and trumpeting with delight, and why not? They're in full plumage, and they're gathered with thousands of their friends. Nature's celebration has carried over with humans. We celebrate October with beer and harvest festivals. At least that's what we do when a pandemic hasn't tossed a wet blanket on our fun. October is a month for everyone who seeks inspiration. The countryside is aflame with color. The skies are crowded with birds. And our inner clocks tell us that we better enjoy October while it lasts. There's a message of inevitability in the crisp breezes that chill our cheeks and noses. We're not so cold in October as we know will come in November, December, and January. So we make the most of it. October always gets here at the right time, when we need a jump start to re-energize for the home stretch. Now that it has arrived, we're fools if we don't take advantage. You're listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Bruce Wiley Anderson passed away on October 5th in Overland Park, Kansas, after a long battle with dementia. He was born on March 2nd, 1934, in Greeley, Colorado, the son of Minnie and Bruce Anderson. Wiley, as he was known by his family and friends, was a professor and department head of the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, Iowa, for 35 years. He received an undergraduate degree in 1956 from the University of Northern Colorado, as well as a master's degree from the University of Denver, a master's degree from the University of Northern Colorado, and a doctorate from the University of Iowa. Wiley served in the United States Army and taught in the public school system of both Greeley, Colorado, and Bakersfield, California. He also taught at Wayne State College in Wayne, Nebraska, Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, and the University of Northern Iowa. Wiley and his wife of 59 years, Rosemary, enjoyed summers in Glen Haven, Colorado. They joined the Summers Residents Association, SRA, of Estes Park, Colorado, and had many friends in the area. Wiley was a member of the board of directors of Norwestel's Fargo Bank for 20 years, a member and presenter of the Missouri Valley Economics Association and the Midwest Economics Association, and a columnist for the Waterloo, Iowa Courier Cedar Falls, Iowa Record for 15 years. He is survived by his wife, Rosemary, his son, Gregory, wife, Pamela, his daughter, Karen, husband, Brian, and three grandchildren, Andy, Devil Biss, Samuel Anderson, and Benjamin Devil Biss. He is preceded in death by his parents, brothers Charles Wilbur Anderson and David Warner Anderson, and sister Pauline Winifred Getman. No memorial services have been planned. Donations in his name may be made to the Salvation Army, his favorite charity. Mary Lou Barnett, 91, St. Joseph, Missouri, passed away Thursday, October 15, 2020. She was born May 18, 1929, in Waterloo, Iowa, to Otis and Dorothy Edwards Follett. Mary Lou was married to Royal Barnett Sr., he who preceded her in death. She was a registered nurse. Mary Lou is preceded in death by her husband, children Kent Barnett, Cynthia England, son-in-laws David Stobaugh, Vernon Daniels. Survivors include children Mary Lee Wagner, Gladstone, Missouri, Elizabeth Stobaugh, St. Joseph, Missouri, Royal Jr. Barnett, wife Deborah, St. Joseph, Missouri, Caroline Daniels, St. Joseph, Missouri, Edward Sr. Barnett, Penny, wife Penny, St. Joseph, Missouri, Timothy Barnett, wife Debbie Belton, Missouri, Kevin Barnett, wife Jenny, St. Joseph, Missouri, several grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Memorial service, 11 a.m. Tuesday, Simplify Cremation and Funerals, Internment, Memorial Park Cemetery. The family will gather with friends 5 to 7 p.m. Monday. Simplify Cremations and Funerals. Obituary and online guestbook at simplifyfunerals.com. Ray McGee Boots, 96, died on Saturday, October 17th at New Aldea Landscapes following a 6-year illness due to stroke. Ray was born August 29, 1934, in Ohio, Missouri, son of William Ray Lucy McGee Boots. He married Patricia Lindy in 1949, and they divorced. He married Myra R. Davis of Cedar Falls in 1966. Ray served in the Navy Air Corps from 1943 to 1946. Following graduation from the University of Northern Iowa, Ray worked as an independent insurance agent and a farm owner and manager. In the past years, Ray had been a member of the American Legion, Shriners, Saratoga Club, and UNI Athletic Club, survived by his wife, two sons, Robert of Waterloo, and John, wife Shelley of Tustin, California, one daughter, Linda Spoon of Wellsville, Pennsylvania, one adopted son, John Scott, wife Doreen Davis of Tigard, Oregon, a son-in-law, Daniel, wife Diana Diemer of Las Cruces, New Mexico, eight grandchildren, Rebecca, Miriam, Taylor, Tyler, Amanda, Timothy, and Olivia, and seven great-grandchildren, Vincent, Gabriel, Riley, Owen, Marlena, Macklin, and Michael, preceded in death by a brother, Robert, and an adopted daughter, Janin Diemer. A private family memorial service will be held at New Aldea Chapel. A celebration of life will be held in the summer of 2021 for friends and family. Memorials may be directed to the UNI Foundation or New Aldea Lifescapes. Richardson Funeral Service is assisting the family. Ray enjoyed his family, golfing with friends, traveling overseas, camping and trailering, fishing and playing cards. He was an ardent fan of UNI athletics and established scholarships for women's volleyball and wrestling athletes. Ray lived a fruitful and caring life and will be missed by all. Kathleen Ann Kathy Boykin, 70, of Denver Sunset Home, died Saturday, October 17th at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. She was born August 24th, 1950, in Waterloo, daughter of Merlin V. and Betty A. Phelps Boykin. Kathy enjoyed being a homemaker. Kathy was very nurturing and had the most wonderful, infectious laugh. She loved music and dancing and her family. She will be remembered as a very sweet soul. Survivors include her mother of Cedar Falls, her brother Stephen Boykin of Denver, six sisters, Barbara, husband Gary Tomlinson of Waterloo, Cynthia, Cindy, husband Jim Hughes of Waterloo, Donna, husband Jay Abeldinger of Punta Gorda, Florida, Linda Boykin of Coralville, Deborah, husband John Deluge of Waterloo, Jennifer, husband Scott Holman of Waterloo, eight nephews and nieces, Christine Holman, Anthony Holman, Joshua, wife Janelle Miller, Jeffrey Miller, Sarah Miller, Evan Deluge, Owen Deluge, and Emily Deluge, preceded in death by her father. Services will be 2 p.m. Wednesday, October 21st, at Faith Evangelical Lutheran Church, with burial in Garden of Memories. Public visitation will be for 1 hour before services at the church on Wednesday. Face coverings are required for anyone attending the visitation or the funeral services. Haggerty Wyckoff Gorup Funeral Service is in charge of arrangements, memorials to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgorup.com. Sports. College football, Cowboys coming off back-to-back bye weeks. The Big 12 reduced the number of games played to 10 at the beginning of the season so teams could have more bye weeks. The bye weeks were added in theory in case a team had a COVID-19 outbreak and had to postpone the game. That postponed game would then be rescheduled to an extra open week. Unfortunately for number 6 Oklahoma State, It had a bye week 2 weeks ago, and then last week, Baylor had to shut down its football activities for a second time due to a COVID outbreak. In essence, Oklahoma State had back-to-back bye weeks. Nothing surprises us this year. You have to roll with the punches, Oklahoma State coach Mike Gundy said. When we started this season, you felt like we'd run into a game or two where we could be COVID issues on our team or another team. Oklahoma State treated its extra bye week just like a normal bye week. We're going to stick to our routines, Gundy said last week, because we had two open weeks. We've been fairly comfortable with what we're doing. We need to keep them focused. They like to play games. That's what they do. But we can't play one this week. If we don't have three good practices this week, our team is mature enough to know that we might not play as well against Iowa State. At the top, Oklahoma State is the highest ranked team in the Big 12 and the only undefeated team in the conference. Iowa State and Kansas State are also undefeated in conference play, but both lost to Sun Belt teams to begin the season. When Oklahoma State plays Iowa State on Saturday in Stillwater, the Big 12 race will become clearer. The players are smart enough to figure out where we sit, Gundy said. We're going to be really challenged over the next month. For some of us, we control our own destiny. Win and you keep going. Get knocked off and then you have to hope somebody beats someone down the road. Oklahoma State's defense ranks number one in the nation in opponent yards per play at just 4.05. But there's a caveat to that number. The Cowboys have played Kansas and West Virginia in conference, two teams that aren't known for their offenses. Beginning with Iowa State, Oklahoma State is entering the toughest part of its schedule. We're going to face some really good quarterbacks that are experienced and have a lot of success, Gundy said. We'll find out exactly where we're at defensively based on the talent and skills positions we're going to face. Oklahoma State's starting quarterback, Spencer Sanders, suffered an injury in the Cowboys' first game. Gundy said he's back to full health and should be ready for the Iowa State game. But in Sanders' absence, true freshman Shane Illingworth has looked impressive, completing 73% of his passes for 483 yards and three touchdowns in the two-plus games he's played. We're alternating reps, and we might play both. I'm not sure right now, Gundy said. We continue to get them both work. Spencer is healthy, and obviously Shane has played pretty good. Then we have Ethan Bullock as our third option, so we're in pretty good shape at the quarterback position. Malcolm Rodriguez is arguably Oklahoma State's best player on defense. The linebacker has 19 tackles, 4 tackles for a loss, 3 hurries, and a sack. After last football season, when the Oklahoma State wrestling team was thin at heavyweight, Rodriguez, a 2-time Oklahoma State champion wrestler, walked on to the Oklahoma State wrestling team. Starting defensive end Brock Martin, who was also a 3-time Oklahoma State wrestling champion, joined Rodriguez in walking on. Neither one saw the mat in competition. Attorney, Iowa saying no to demands only emboldens ex-players. The attorneys representing 8 black former Iowa football players who allege racial discrimination during their time with the Hawkeyes sent Monday night the university's rejection of their demands, which included a payment of $20 million, is not the end of the matter. Civil rights attorney DeMario Solomon Simmons of Tulsa, Oklahoma, had stated the players' demands in a 21-page letter to university officials dated October 5th. In addition to $20 million, the players called for the firings of head football coach Kirk Ferentz, offensive line coach Brian Ferentz, and athletic director Gary Barta. The university's general counsel office issued its response Sunday, saying it would not give in to the demands and that work had already begun to create a more welcoming environment for Black athletes. The general counsel's response was issued to the media along with a copy of Solomon Simmons' original letter. In response, it appears that Iowa released our confidential letter to the media with the sole intention of trying to shame and intimidate our courageous clients, Solomon Simmons said in a statement. It did not work. In fact, Iowa's move has not only strengthened the resolve of our clients to continue to stand up for their rights and the rights of their teammates. The former players who have said they were mistreated are Akram Wadley, Aaron Menz, Jonathan Parker, Marcel Jolie, Maurice Fleming, Reggie Spearman, Cavante Martin Manley, and Andre Harris. Solomon Simmons did not respond to an Associated Press request to interview the former players. Other attempts to reach the players were unsuccessful. Solomon Simmons' original letter said, if the players' demands were not met by Monday, the former players would file a lawsuit seeking damages. The university in June hired an outside law firm to review the culture of the football program after dozens of former players, most of them Black, spoke out on social media to allege racial disparity and mistreatment. Their activism came as protests against racial injustices swept the nation following the death of George Floyd and after attempts to raise concern inside the program resulted in only minor changes. The athletic department cut ties with longtime strength and conditioning coach Chris Doyle, who received $1.1 million in a severance agreement. Several players have accused Doyle of using racial slurs when addressing them, an allegation he denied. Brian Ferentz, the son of Kurt Ferentz, also was alleged to have been abusive to players. The review, which included interviews with 111 current and former players and employees, found the cultural problems were systemic. The players' demand letter called for the university make a payment of $10 million for the loss of earnings capacity, loss of professional opportunities, defamation, pain and suffering, mental condition, mental anguish, PTSD, humiliation, and overall emotional distress that our clients have incurred. In addition, they sought $10 million to set up a fund, establish four athletes, not including the eight former football players, to compensate them for the discrimination and ongoing severe and pervasive acts that constitute intentional discrimination, where defendants intended to treat African Americans differently. The players also wanted mandatory annual anti-racist training for all athletic department staff, the creation of a permanent senior Black male administrator position, and tuition rate waivers for Black athletes who attended Iowa during Kurt Ferentz's 22 years and did not graduate. Our monetary demands for our clients and over 100 other African American athletes may be short-sightedly characteristic as a money grab by some, Solomon Simmons said in a statement. But our demand is just because the need for vindication and accountability is just. The need for meaningful change and not mere administrative shuffles of Black employees for the sake of public relations is just. Solomon Simmons said the issue of racial discrimination won't be erased by diversity councils, grandiose statements of support, helmet decals, unity walks, prepaid expensive reports, kumbaya implicit bias seminars, and tokenizing of a few Black faculty, athletes, and staff. U.S. trust in COVID-19 information down, poll finds, deadline looms for relief deal, and more. Americans have lost trust across the board in the people and institutions informing them about the coronavirus since the beginning of the pandemic, according to a new poll from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, and USA Facts. The poll finds that the percentage of people saying they trust COVID-19 information from their state or local governments, the news media, social media, and their friends and family has dropped significantly compared to similar questions in April. A large chunk of Americans say they find it hard to know if coronavirus is accurate. Just 16% say they trust coronavirus information from President Donald Trump a great deal or quite a bit, down from 23% in April. And 64% now say they trust Trump only a little or not at all on COVID-19. Only social media at 72% is less trusted. Here's an update on all developments. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reported some progress in advance of a Tuesday deadline for reaching a pre-election deal with President Donald Trump on a new coronavirus relief package. But the same core programs bedeviled the effort remain in place despite optimistic talk from the president and his team. Countries across Europe are battling coronavirus infection spikes with new lockdowns, curfews, face mask orders, and virus-tracking smartphone apps. Spain's health minister says the government won't extend the state of emergency in the Madrid area when it expires on Saturday, but may introduce curfews at coronavirus hotspots around the country. UK researchers are preparing to infect healthy young volunteers with the virus that caused COVID-19, becoming the first scientists to use the controversial technique to study the disease and potentially speed up development of a vaccine that could help end the pandemic. State-owned Chinese drug maker is setting up production lines to supply 1 billion doses of two possible coronavirus vaccines that are being tested on 50,000 people in 10 countries, the company chairman said Tuesday. The British government has given the city of Manchester a noon Tuesday deadline to agree to tighter coronavirus measures as Prime Minister Boris Johnson struggles to impose his plan for localized restrictions to unrestive region. Deadline looms, but COVID relief deal may be far off. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reported some progress in advance of a Tuesday deadline for reaching a pre-election deal with President Donald Trump on a new coronavirus package, but the same core programs bedeviling the effort remain in place despite optimistic talk from the president and the team. Pelosi negotiated for nearly an hour Monday with Trump's top emissary, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and her office said they are continuing to narrow their differences. Finally, they have come to the table and we're going to try to get something done, Pelosi said on MSNBC Monday evening. She said the two sides would take stock on Tuesday, which she has staked out as a deadline if a deal is to be reached before the election. Let's make a judgment. We may not like this, We may not like that, but let's see on balance if we can move forward. But with time nearly up for Congress and the White House to deliver aid to Americans before the election, the question remains, if not now, when? It's a key consideration for Trump, who has talked up the prospect of another package as he asks voters for a second term, and for Democratic hopefuls with their nominee Joe Biden is on the cusp of winning the White House in November. Nancy Pelosi at this moment does not want to do anything that's going to affect the election, Trump said during a campaign swing in Arizona. The dynamic has created a tricky position for Pelosi, whose tough approach to the talks and durable GOP opposition to a potential deal of almost $2 trillion has left all sides staring at the very real potential of the negotiations failing. Pelosi is angling for the best deal she can get. Maybe that's now, maybe that's later. It's a risk she's willing to take. Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, meanwhile, is pushing ahead with votes this week on GOP measures that stand little chance of advancing. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.